are most effective when combined, and the worse your endowment or trends, the more moves you need to make. What surprises most business leaders we talk to is just how big a big move really needs to be. Over the many decades of interacting with and advising business leaders around the world, we've so often seen teams start with big ambitions only to have them drain away. Why is it so hard to make big moves, moves that change the odds? As we've said before, just because a move feels big, is hard to do, or takes a lot of resources, this does not mean it's a big move. You need an external reference point. It has to be big versus what the rest of the world is doing. You have to take the outside view. Don't get stuck inside. Big moves feel scary. Risk aversion is human and permeates all parts of many organizations. The CEO may be trying to deliver on the quarter rather than thinking a decade ahead. My legacy matters. I won't mess it up with this acquisition. Elsewhere, managers are not ready to take risks with new initiatives. One might be concerned about not achieving an ambitious target or similar career-limiting actions. Another might fear neglecting other priorities and thus spreads effort too widely and too thinly. Or, perhaps a founder chairman has made billions and simply doesn't want to take perceived risks that would put his fortunes or social status in peril. You might think that once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur, but that's not always the case. We have seen more than once successful entrepreneurs turn cautious and push their teams into an incremental, let's make next year just a bit better than this year. For many, entrepreneurship is great, as long as they're not the ones taking the career risk. In many situations, you might end up with a finger-pointing exercise. The CEO of a consumer business in India blamed the front line. We have the right strategy, but my team does not execute. Others say there's something wrong with the strategy, or with the CEO, or with both. Most often, though, unexpected one-time effects are blamed for not progressing on the power curve. Big moves are essential. We're sympathetic to all these problems. We recognize our own humanity in many of them. But our research found that big moves are essential if you're to improve your chances of moving up the power curve. So it isn't enough to just understand that big moves have historically been hard. We have to escape the past and get to a place where big moves become possible, even encouraged. Fortunately, once you open the windows of the strategy room and bring in the outside view, you can use these empirics and what we learn from them to change the game. Not because they are another set of numbers, but because calibrating and benchmarking strategies allows you to change the dialogue in the room. You have compelling arguments based on clear evidence that big moves do matter. As we've seen, companies in the middle quintiles of the power curve have an 8% chance of reaching the top quintile over a decade. Making one or two big moves, i.e. pulling one or two of the five levers hard enough to matter, more than doubles those odds to 17%. Three big moves boost these odds to 47%. Irresistible odds, as we will see later for the likes of BASF, Konica Minolta, and Asahi, which all succeeded in making multiple big moves to scale the power curve. Companies that made three or more big moves were six times more likely to jump from the middle quintile to the top. Unfortunately, it is rare that companies will make more than a single big move. Of all the companies that started in the middle of the power curve, roughly 40% didn't make any big moves at all over the 10-year period. Another nearly 40% only made one, Exhibit 24. There's actually more action from the bottom group, highlighting that weak performance is a catalyst for change. There were 60 companies in our research that pulled four or five levers in the period 2000 to 2004 to 2010 to 2014. Within this group of 60 strong movers, 40 were upwardly mobile, and there were no downwardly mobile companies. Just take a second to reflect on that. Not a single company that pulled four or five levers slid down on the power curve. If that's not getting you thinking, we don't know what would. Of the 60 companies that pulled 4 or 5 levers, 2 moved from the middle to the top, and 22 made the more impressive leap from the bottom quintile to the top quintile, Exhibit 25. Included in that group are heavy equipment manufacturer Komatsu, hotel operator Starwood Hotels, media conglomerates Disney and 21st Century Fox, Canadian telco TELUS, aerospace and defense suppliers Rolls-Royce Holdings, Precision Cast Parts, Harris Corp, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, and other well-known names including Japan Airlines, Goodyear, and Mitsubishi Electric. Growing economic profit is not always accompanied by growing sales. For example, Goodyear grew their profit margins while experiencing a top-line decline in the latter half of the period. Communications technology company Harris made 4 of the 5 big moves over the decade. Programmatic mergers, acquisitions and divestitures, M&A&D, dynamic resource reallocation, productivity improvement in terms of labor and overhead, and differentiation with gross margin expansion. Check out their mobility dashboard in Exhibit 26. Harris also benefited from an industry megatrend, low debt, and high R&D spending in the past. That's 7 boxes ticked out of the 10 mobility attributes, which is why Harris had an 80% probability of moving from the middle to the top of the power curve. The move produced a 13% CAGR in total shareholder return over the decade. Corning's story. Corning pulled all 5 of the big moves over the 10-year period and leaped from bottom to top. Their sales productivity went up by 80%, gross margin expanded by 14%, the ratio of SG&A to sales fell by 30%. Corning spent $14 billion on CapEx and net $3.2 billion on acquisitions, 12 acquisitions and 9 divestments. Despite starting in the bottom quintile, Corning gave itself a 78% chance of at least moving to the middle and fully a 49% chance of reaching the top quintile. Corning's average annual economic profit improved by around $1.7 billion. And importantly, 90% of the improvement in Corning's economic profit was attributable to the company, not the market, not the industry, but to Corning's big moves. Corning's story is more fascinating than just the numbers. For a company with a long and proud history, having made the glass encasing Thomas Edison's light bulb, windows for the Apollo lunar landings, and the first fiber optic cable, consider the challenges that Corning faced in the early 2000s. Heavily invested in telecommunications, Corning was hit hard by the bursting of the dot-com bubble. Revenue halved. Profits turned into heavy losses, and the share price plummeted 99% from its peak in September 2000 to its low in October 2002. Corning's approach to recovery was a balance of scaling back the portfolio and scrutinizing the cost base, but also maintaining investment in R&D and long-term growth, the latter very difficult under the short-term pressure of shareholders. Corning produced an amazing turnaround based on big moves. Here is a detailed look at our 5 big moves and why they matter so much, with a few examples sprinkled in along the way. Programmatic M&A and divestitures. The myth that 75% of all mergers fail has long been dispelled. It was based on a statistic related to announcement day effect that failed to capture the reality of corporate value creation, not to mention the many smaller deals that don't get announced, but cumulatively matter a lot. M&A does work as a growth lever, but success depends very much on the type of M&A program a company is running. The path that holds the most promise is programmatic M&A. Our research found that the most successful style of M&A executes on average at least one deal per year in a program that cumulatively amounts to more than 30% of market capitalization over 10 years, with no single deal being more than 30% of market cap. Companies that meet this standard on M&A have cleared the threshold and made a big move. The findings make sense, considering that M&A requires mastery of capabilities through repeated deals. M&A requires a set of capabilities that are built over time as a result of practice. Companies that execute programmatic M&A over years, often decades, become true masters of the art of identifying, negotiating, and integrating acquisitions. Companies that do very few deals struggle to execute well the few they do. Practice makes perfect. The adage holds. Our research has shown that infrequent large deals tend to hurt value creation. Corning shows the value of this move. At all times, they seek to maintain a strong M&A pipeline that is about 5 to 10 times their annual target for increasing revenue through acquisitions. Corning understands that doing 3 deals a year means it has to do due diligence on 20 companies and submit 5 bids. Axel Springer and WPP also show the value of programmatic M&A, as we described in a bit of detail in the section on the importance of recognizing and acting on trends. Axel Springer, the giant German publisher, made a decisive move from print to digital by making 67 mostly small acquisitions between 2006 and 2012, while launching 90 publications organically and divesting itself of 8. The company's disciplined approach to M&A repositioned it solidly for the digital age and led to a 10% CAGR in total shareholder return over the decade. While the company had lost some momentum as of the writing of this book, global marketing powerhouse WPP is a strong example of programmatic M&A. In the early days, following WPP's pivot from industrial manufacturing to marketing services, major acquisitions were the fastest way to achieve scale in its new industry. WPP acquired JWT for $566 million in 1987 and Ogilvy for $864 million in 1989. Those two acquisitions were big enough that WPP admits stretching their balance sheet and risking distress. However, since then, WPP has practiced programmatic M&A and made it one of the company's strongest muscles. Over the 10-year sample period, WPP made 271 acquisitions. That's more than one per fortnight, which was 60% more transactions than the next busiest acquirer, Alphabet Incorporated. WPP began the period in the middle of the power curve with average economic profit of $8 million, but ended with a top quintile worthy $677 million. The company saw an 11% CAGR in total shareholder return over the decade. The repetition of M&A will help you get past the curse of introspection. It also will help strengthen the capabilities of your business. M&A and post-merger integration programs are not innate talents. They are mastery, acquired by doing them over and over again. Active resource reallocation. Peanut butter can taste great on a sandwich, but this is not about taste, and spreading peanut butter doesn't work for allocating resources, capital, operating expenses, and talent to the most important growth opportunities across the company. Spreading resources evenly provides too much to those units that aren't going to make a big move or can't, while depriving those one or two that could turn into huge opportunities. The social side of strategy creates peanut butter tendencies and causes inertia about those allocation decisions. The needed reallocation isn't just movement between industries, geographies, operating segments, business units, projects, products, or customer groups. It's all of the above. Breaking inertia, freeing up resources from underperforming units, and shifting them to overperforming units creates value at all levels irrespective of how you define those units. The problem, of course, is that in a world of finite resources, reallocating resources to one inevitably requires deallocating resources from another. And this is where the friction and inertia set in. Here's a fact that will be near and dear to every CEO's heart. At a time when average CEO tenures are rapidly dropping, CEOs who aggressively move in their first few years to reallocate resources to new growth spaces tend to keep their jobs longer than their more reluctant peers. Dynamic reallocation creates value. The analytics are unambiguous. Companies that shift more than 50% of their capital expenditure across business units over 10 years create 50% more value over that period than companies that move resources at a slower clip. Again, just shifting some isn't enough. You have to clear that 50% threshold to get the big boost in your odds of reaching the top quintile. Reckitt Benckiser made a big move when the British consumer goods company decided to rearticulate priorities and within 2 weeks increased the resources allocated to a promising area by a factor of 2.5. At Virgin, Richard Branson has been the very model of resource reallocation while building a personal fortune of some $5 billion. He started in record stores, moved to music, then to airlines. His Virgin Group now controls more than 400 companies and continues its relentless reallocation of resources to promising opportunities in renewable fuels, healthcare, and even space travel and Elon Musk's Hyperloop venture. Well before agreeing to sell $52.4 billion of assets to Walt Disney in late 2017, 21st Century Fox migrated its resource allocation to support the evolution of media consumption habits. Fox shifted away from traditional print media to focus on filmed content and broadcasting. Back in 2001, 50% of News Corp's operating income came from print media, and only 6% from cable network programming. After spinning off its print assets and rebranding, 21st Century Fox made 2/3 of its operating income from cable and none from print. Total shareholder return grew at a 10% CAGR over the decade. When Frans van Houten became Philips CEO in 2011, the company began divesting itself of legacy assets, including its TV and audio businesses. After this portfolio restructuring, Philips succeeded at reinvigorating its growth engine by reallocating resources to more promising businesses, oral care and healthcare were two priorities, and geographies. Philips started, for example, managing performance and resource allocations at the level of more than 340 business market combinations, such as power toothbrushes in China and respiratory care in Germany. That led to an acceleration of growth, with the consumer business moving from the company's worst performing segment to its best performing one within 5 years. Danaher has practiced active resource reallocation throughout its long history, and accordingly, the company has continually innovated. For what was originally a real estate investment trust, Danaher now boasts a wide portfolio of science, technology, and manufacturing companies across life sciences, diagnostics, environmental and applied solutions, and dental, although these segments are periodically reviewed and recut to avoid allocation inertia. Danaher has made sure its structure and processes create resource liquidity to chase the best opportunities at any point in time. Like a private equity firm, the management team spends half of their time focused on resource reallocation, including M&A opportunities, organic investments, and divestments. One fundamental process sitting behind Danaher's success is the Danaher Business System, or DBS. The system draws on concepts like lean manufacturing and the Kaizen philosophy of continuous improvement. DBS is used to identify the best investment opportunities, drive operational improvements to free up resources, and create world-class capabilities in the businesses Danaher acquires. Danaher was a top quintile company throughout our research, but big moves such as dynamic resource reallocation, business model differentiation, and programmatic M&A lifted its economic profit by an additional $512 million, placing it even higher on the power curve. total shareholder return grew at a 12% CAGR over the decade. Exhibit 27 shows just how aggressively Danaher reallocated capital. Reallocation is not just limited to CapEx across segments. Reallocation within segments is important too, and so is reallocation of operating expenses. A diversified North American industrial conglomerate looked at R&D and sales expenditure by product line within its U.S. market segments. It used an analytical process to find products that it would classify as sustain, those that are profitable but not necessarily the most attractive, where the main goal is sustaining current profitability rather than pursuing growth. The process used several filters to find the sustain products. Was the product dilutive to margin? Was it dilutive to growth? Was it an attractive market? Did the company have strategic advantage in that market? Was the product material enough to free up meaningful resources? And was the product sufficiently independent from the rest of the portfolio to minimize adverse spillover from reduced allocation? The company found 15 of its 80 products were sustain products, and from them identified $35 to $45 million of R&D and sales spending that could be freed up and reallocated, representing approximately 10% of the division's allocation. To reallocate, you have to deallocate. Now that might all sound great, but reallocating resources is often not so easy. If you don't build a cushy balance sheet, the showstopper when trying to reallocate resources happens typically on October 31st, after the first round of the annual planning process, when it is evident that there are no resources available to be reallocated. You may also have trouble when a strategically important M&A comes along and you just don't have the resources. Taking resources away from a unit on the spur of the moment is much harder than handing out resources, so you need to plan ahead. Cut resources in January to have flexibility to hand out resources in August. Often, it turns out to be much easier to identify the likely losers than the likely winners. Most executives we know usually have little trouble agreeing which businesses will fail, unless they're the ones running them. So you can cut costs at some units. You can also raise capital and sell assets or businesses to stockpile resources. The social side of strategy makes resource allocations sticky. Inertia matters a lot, and so do our organizational silos. We often don't look at all our resources in their proper context and see how they can be shared or moved. The inside view keeps getting tighter and tighter as you go down the company structure. Strong capital programs. The third big move is to expand faster than the industry. Pulling the CapEx lever turns into a big move when your CapEx to sales ratio exceeds 1.7 times the industry median for at least 10 years. Successful capital programs manage a pipeline, making sure you aren't just investing in options that you know are in the money, making sure you're investing in some riskier medium-term options for the company and some longer-term even higher-risk options, making sure your pipeline of investments is full. Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer TSMC succeeded by going anti-cyclical when the internet bubble burst and demand for semiconductors dropped sharply. TSMC bought mission-critical equipment at the trough of the crisis and was ready for the demand as soon as it came back. TSMC had been in a head-to-head race before the crisis, but pulled clear of the competition after it ended because of its through-cycle investment strategy. That laid the foundation for establishing technology leadership in subsequent years, making TSMC one of the largest and most successful semiconductor manufacturing pure plays in the world. The company's total shareholder return grew at a 15% CAGR over the decade. Canadian National Railway moved to the top quintile with a significant CapEx program. Over the period 2005 to 2014, CN invested more than $17 billion Canadian in CapEx, a staggering 85% of the capital base that it had in 2004. Railroads are a capital-intensive business, and more than half of CN's investment went into track infrastructure. However, the investment wasn't just about sprawling farther and wider. The route miles of CN's network hardly changed over the decade. No, most of the track capex went into repairs and upgrades that would open capacity and improve operational efficiency of the network. For example, building longer sidings to support longer trains. The program was associated with an 18% CAGR in total shareholder return over the decade, making the formerly state-owned CN one of the most successful privatizations ever. For Fortescue Metals, the opportunity was in constructing its Pilbara mines while the iron ore price supported it, and it went on to build a major global force in mining from nothing. For Patrick Stevedores, the opportunity was replacing labor with automation, which lifted throughput, reduced costs, improved safety, and won back some bargaining power over unions. There must, of course, be real discipline and robust investment processes. If a project doesn't generate returns at least equal to the cost of capital, it's actually destroying value for shareholders. Again, this is one of the reasons why we use economic profit after capital charges have been deducted as our measure of financial performance for observing the power curve. Caution on CapEx. CapEx in itself doesn't make a strategy successful. Additional capacity is just excess capacity unless there is underlying demand for it. Spending CapEx can be a positive or a negative depending on whether it is based on privileged assets or insights. This is different than the other big moves, which are clearly asymmetric. They increase the odds of moving up while simultaneously decreasing the risk of sliding down. CapEx is more like an amplifier, pushing you faster in either direction. Santos is a cautionary example. The Australian gas company, whose contracts tend to be linked to oil, pulled the CapEx lever hard and invested heavily over 2011 to 2014 as it developed new projects and expanded its existing Cooper Basin asset. The crude oil price had rallied since the financial crisis and found some relative stability between $100 and $120 per barrel. Over the 4 years, Santos invested approximately $10 billion in CapEx, which, until the projects became operational, were extremely costly and a heavy drag on economic profit. Santos slid to the bottom quintile of the power curve during this heavy period of investment. And maybe that would have been okay, because big projects take time to operate and bear fruit. But then the oil price halved in 2015, and it hasn't recovered. Not surprisingly, Santos found it very challenging to deal with the subsequent cash flow problems. Distinctive productivity improvement. Productivity programs are a management favorite. They are mostly under management control, a lever that can be pulled with relative certainty. Companies like Toyota made their fortunes based on productivity-led advantages. However, everybody does these programs, so do they really move the needle, or do they help to just keep up with the industry? Productivity programs only make a real difference once you clear a high threshold. You have to deliver 25% more productivity improvement than your industry median over a 10-year period. If your industry improves productivity at 2% per year, your program would need to consistently deliver above 2.5% per year. Sounds like not too much, but very few companies manage to do 25% better than the rest of the industry every year over a 10-year period. Pulling this lever hard normally requires extraordinary means and efforts. In our experience, Six Sigma, Lean, and other methodologies have contributed enormously over the last few decades to extraordinary productivity improvements. However, even more important than the methodology is the productivity program itself. Being able to force the entire organization into consistently driving productivity over time and capturing the bottom line impact are real differentiators. Toyota succeeded in such a big way primarily by establishing a company-wide culture of continuous productivity improvement that is deeply embedded and constantly reinforced. Running fast and getting nowhere. What struck us, though, is that many companies do feel like they're running rather fast but getting nowhere, relative to the competition. All too often, the hard work on productivity is given away in pricing, or worse, lost when other parts of the organization absorb the gains. The dreaded German sausage effect. You squeeze on one end, and the fat sloshes to the other end. Car companies invested heavily to shorten the product life cycle of models from 12 years to 7 years to 5, and to even faster refresh rates. But everyone did so, so no one gained a substantial advantage. Intel and AMD got into a chip productivity battle in the 1990s and spent billions, but stayed basically even with each other. The phenomenon recalls the arms race between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, where both improved at a furious pace, but neither could win, until the mid-1980s, when Reagan started seriously outspending the Soviets and pulled a big move on them. Global toy and entertainment company Hasbro successfully achieved the top quintile of the power curve with a big move in productivity. Hasbro faced challenges managing a complex portfolio of businesses, utilizing a large network of global outsourced vendors. Inefficiencies emerged through labor-intensive processes and communication lags across time zones, which became untenable when trends moved against the company. Hasbro's financial performance hit rock bottom with an operating loss of $104 million due to a big drop in toy revenue. Hasbro embarked on a turnaround, which aimed for it to be a smaller but more profitable version of itself, with a focus on its core brands, for example, Transformers, Tonka, Play-Doh, and Monopoly. The following decade saw Hasbro consolidate business units and sites, invest in automated processing, invest in customer self-service, reduce headcount, and exit loss-making business units. Hasbro's SG&A expenses as a proportion of sales fell from an average of 42% at the beginning of the research period to 29% 10 years later. Sales productivity lifted too, by a lot in fact. Over the 10-year period, Hasbro shed more than a quarter of its workforce yet still grew total revenue by 33%, assisted by the successful launch of the Transformers movie franchise, an initiative led by current CEO Brian Goldner, who joined Hasbro in 2000 to take over the suffering U.S. toys segment. Hasbro's total shareholder return grew at a CAGR of 15% over the decade. German chemicals manufacturer BASF SE moved from the middle to the top of the power curve with the help of good endowment and positive trends, but it capitalized on this beneficial starting position with three big moves: programmatic M&A, resource reallocation, and especially an improvement in both overhead and sales productivity. The moves helped lead to total shareholder return increasing at a CAGR of 17% over the decade. BASF pays lots of attention to return on capital. When Chairman Jürgen Hambrecht took over in 2004, earning a premium over our cost of capital was the first point in his 10-year strategic plan. Achieving that meant making operations as efficient as possible and being prudent with the investment of new capital. BASF saw productivity as a necessary way of strengthening its competitiveness. BASF's productivity improvements were particularly notable versus its peers in the chemicals industry. Over the decade, BASF successfully reduced its SG&A to sales ratio by 40%, while the median improvement in the industry was 25%. BASF lifted its sales productivity by 110% versus the industry average improvement of 70%. Now, with an inside view, most managers would be thrilled with a 25% reduction in overhead and a 70% improvement in sales productivity. But with an outside view, you see, that's just keeping up. You have to do even better in the chemicals industry to make productivity a big move that creates competitive advantage. How did BASF do it? The story has two main elements: merciless performance management with a focus on return on capital, and participation in the global trends of demand growth and industry consolidation. BASF believes that its Verbund principle is instrumental in delivering world-class productivity. Verbund, literally composite, originates from BASF's flagship plants, which can manufacture a diverse range of finished products, thereby creating flexible capacity utilization and pooled use of inputs. BASF today has 6 such plants, 2 in Europe, 2 in North America, and 2 in Asia. But today, the Verbund concept permeates all of BASF, not just its production processes, which creates a culture of cooperation, knowledge sharing, innovation, and operating efficiency throughout the organization. Verbund drives efficiency in the consumption of resources, capital, OPEX, and headcount. Productivity matters, and it matters even more relative to other big moves when your business already is in the top quintile of companies on the power curve. Structuring and launching an effective, sustained productivity program is not easy, but in the age of machine learning and artificial intelligence, new tools to accelerate such programs are becoming mainstream. Previously unheard-of performance step changes, such as improving the productivity of R&D engineering teams by up to 30% over 24 months, are within reach now. Differentiation improvement. The 5th big move covers some of the more interesting aspects of strengthening the competitiveness of a business. The innovation in products, services, and even business models. Differentiation improvements also covers gains in market share, such a common topic of conversation, and pricing, which while admittedly not as sexy as innovation, is nonetheless a big lever for relative performance improvements. Differentiation, expressed here in the comparison between the average gross margin of companies and that of their industry, is a way of summarizing just how much customers value a company's products and services relative to its competitors. Based on our data set, we now know how much differentiation is required to make an impact. 30%. Your average gross margin needs to exceed your industry's by 30% over a decade for you to materially increase your chances of moving up the power curve. German broadcaster ProSiebenSat.1 moved to the top quintile of the power curve by shifting its model for a new era of media with several innovations. One such strategy opened up ProSieben's addressable client base by using a media for equity offering for customers whose business would significantly benefit from mass media, but who couldn't afford to pay with cash. Some of ProSieben's innovations were costly, sometimes even cannibalizing existing businesses, but believing that the industry was going to move anyway, the company decided that experimenting with change was a matter of survival first and profitability second. ProSieben's gross margin expanded from 16% to 53% during our research period. Memory card manufacturer SanDisk made a big move investing in innovation and ultimately improved its gross margins, leading to a 13% CAGR in total shareholder return over the decade. Appreciating that it was a strong player in a good market, SanDisk went ahead of the industry in capital expenditure, reducing circuitry size, lowering manufacturing costs, and increasing output. SanDisk kept its prices at a premium to the market and invested heavily in trade promotion and its SanDisk Extreme team, a public network of expert photographers, as a centerpiece of a lively and permanent social media presence. Over the 10 years, SanDisk successfully expanded its gross margins from 40% to 48%, while the broader industry experienced modest gross margin contraction. In the context of a good industry trend, SanDisk achieved average economic profit of $945 million at the end of the period, which moved it to the top quintile of the power curve. At the beginning of our research period, British luxury fashion house Burberry was experiencing somewhat of an identity crisis, and its luxury status was under threat. By the early 2000s, the company's distinctive camel-colored check had become the uniform of the chav, the stereotypical white working-class delinquent looking for trouble. Bouncers and taxi drivers learned to turn away young men sporting Burberry baseball caps and jackets. The brand's elite reputation seemed to be lost. The brand's defense against this apparent drift included vertical integration into the retail channel. Burberry grew its retail store footprint aggressively through Burberry-branded stores, concessions in department stores, and outlets. From having only 145 stores contributing 38% to group revenue in 2004, the company saw the retail channel grow to 497 stores plus digital commerce, contributing 70% of revenue a decade later. The retail channel gave Burberry more control over the way customers interacted with its brand. Burberry now controls everything, from the way sales staff greet customers and the training they receive, to the store ambience and visual merchandising, to the consistency between stores and digital platforms and direct marketing. The stronger mix on retail gave gross margins a boost by saving on the retailer's middleman margin and increased bargaining power with its wholesale customers by reducing the brand's dependency on that channel. It's no fluke that, among retail companies on the power curve, those with vertically integrated models and premium brand positions, as well as those with fierce discount credentials, were much more likely to jump up quintiles than the traditional mid-market aggregator retail models. Burberry also aspired to lead retail innovation with digital. Since 2006, with the appointment of CEO Angela Ahrendts, Burberry's vision has been to be the first company that is fully digital. Social media is now crucial to the brand's relationship with modern customers, and the company's followers exceed 40 million across many platforms. Burberry aims to provide seamless interaction between the brand's physical and digital presences. For example, the flagship store on Regent Street in London has interactive digital mirrors that respond to RFID chips embedded in products. Point of sale has moved from the checkout to the sofa, where shoppers can use digital payment technologies such as Apple Pay. Burberry runway shows are live streamed in 3D, and store launches have become avant-garde digital showcases. At the 2014 launch of Burberry's Shanghai store, a partnership with WeChat allowed subscribers to immerse themselves in 360 degrees of fashion, music, and dance. This, of course, is also a brilliant example of strategic capital reallocation. Furthermore, Burberry leveraged the brand into adjacent product lines. In 2004, accessories and children's contributed only 30% of group revenue. By 2014, these categories grew to 40% of group sales revenue. Burberry also successfully launched a high-margin beauty products range, which grew to 7% of group revenue. With a greater mix of retail and new higher-margin product lines, as well as investment in supply chain to meet digital needs and keep supply costs low, Burberry's gross margin expanded from 59% at the beginning of our research to 76% at the end. Economic profit rose from $92 million to $435 million, putting it deservedly in the top quintile of the power curve. Total shareholder return grew at a CAGR of 17% over the decade. Much of what goes into differentiation is hard to do. It's difficult to find all the niches where you can stand out. Innovation befuddles many. Even if they can spot trends in technology that could benefit them, for example, bringing those inside the business is more easily aspired to than done. Differentiation requires long-term thinking, which is hard while you're on the quarterly earnings treadmill. Have we not cut the R&D budget when we needed to make this year's budget? A fascinating analysis on the impact of private ownership shows that private firms invest approximately double the rate that similar matched public firms do. Engaging in the quarterly earnings game really does drive short-termism. Did we not launch a product prematurely, sacrificing some margin to make sure we had good news for the market? There is hardly an area in the repertoire of strategic moves that is more easily sacrificed for short-term gain than the differentiation lever. Are you playing to your advantage? This is where management objectives, incentives, and the long-term interest of shareholders often collide. When we use the 10 timeless tests of strategy to check the quality of strategies, it is often test number 2 that leads to the most extensive and revealing discussions. Does your strategy tap your true source of competitive advantage? In other words, does it strengthen your differentiation? That breaks into 2 questions. First, do you understand what the source of your competitive advantage is? Do you know why you make money today? These turn out to be incredibly interesting questions. If you ask 10 people, you get as many different answers. At a retail bank in Australia, for instance, the leaders wanted to expand into overseas markets. The logic was, we're very successful, so we must be better operators than our competitors. We'll move into other markets where the operations aren't nearly as efficient as in our home markets, and we'll clean up. When we looked at how the bank actually made money, though, all the operating metrics were unimpressive. They made money based on product strategy. They had a big exposure to residential mortgages, for which demand was very strong in Australia at the time. The even bigger source of profit was that the bank was superb at picking branch locations. But the choices were made by 2 guys in a back office, so there wasn't any reason to suspect that they would be anywhere near as successful in Indonesia or other new countries. Second, do you leverage what makes you special? When we looked into why multi-business conglomerates in Asia grew successfully, we found a very different strategy. On average, they entered a new business every 18 months. Almost 70% of their moves were driven by M&A, and half of the growth came from step-out moves, not acquisitions in adjacent markets or in their value chains. That seemed odd. But further investigation found that each acquisition leveraged an important capability, even if that wasn't immediately obvious. It wasn't just that a company knew an industry. It might be that someone had a special relationship. They were in online gaming and knew the regulators, so they expanded into banking. They were in real estate, so they had land, and they moved into large-scale manufacturing. While the strategies might have looked unusual, there were smart people at the helm of these companies, and they very much understood both how they made money and how they could turn those competitive advantages into more money. Big moves make for good strategy. Understanding the role of big moves in your strategy is more than just what they are and how they work in isolation. It's also how they work together. The following dynamics are the most important to understand about big moves and about the very fabric of good strategy. Big moves are really valuable. The beauty of empirics is that we now know how much your big moves add to the value of a company. Check out the matrix in Exhibit 28. It shows the expected economic profit in 2010 to 2014 of a firm starting in the middle tier in 2000 to 2004 based on the endowment and trend they inherit, the columns, and the strengths of their moves, the rows. 2 things stand out. First, cast your eyes north-south and you see, no matter what the inheritance, it always pays to add more big moves. Second, look down the diagonal. What you will see is that, roughly speaking, really big moves can cancel out the impact of poor inheritance. In other words, strong moves with a poor inheritance, $260 million, is about as valuable as poor moves with a strong inheritance, $161 million. Of course, if you could choose, you would have both and get a whopping expected payoff of $1.36 billion, but only a handful of firms manage to do that. Even small improvements in odds have a dramatic impact on the expected payoff, owing to the extremely steep rise of the power curve. For example, the probability-weighted expected value of middle-tier companies increasing their odds to 27% from the average of 8% is $123 million, nearly 3 times the total average economic profit for middle-tier companies. Big moves are non-linear. Many business leaders would lean back and say, "Of course these five moves are part of our strategy." But that's not true. Even for many businesses that have these levers articulated in their strategies, the businesses are not executing on the moves, at least not enough to make a real difference. As we've shown, making modest efforts on these five moves doesn't improve your odds. Moves are non-linear. Just pulling a lever does not help. You need to pull it hard enough to make a difference. For instance, as we've noted, productivity improvements that are roughly in line with the improvement rates of the industry you are playing in do not matter. The probability of moving up only improves above a certain threshold. In the case of productivity improvements, for instance, your rate needs to be at least 25% above the industry average to make a difference. You are only making a big move if you have cleared the threshold for its respective lever. Big moves must be big relative to your industry. Even if you're improving all five measures, what matters is how you stack up against your competitors. You need to outrun if you want to win. Locked inside the stuffy strategy room, amid the detailed introspection, teams can lose sight of the fact that they aren't the only ones in the industry. Chances are their competitors are working hard, too. Managers may still think they're being aggressive with their moves, and they might have grand plans about how high their margins can get and who they're going to take over. But the reality is that everyone is trying to do the same thing. If everybody cuts costs by 5% or brings out a similar product, where's the advantage? You have to do the work, but that's just keeping up. Big moves compound. One move isn't enough either if you really want to improve your odds. Moves are additive. Making one move is good, two is much better, and three is much better than that. Without getting deep into the math, the basic idea is that making one move will nearly double your odds of making it from the middle quintiles to the top. A second move roughly doubles those odds again. A third nearly doubles the odds again, and so on. That math isn't exactly accurate, but it illustrates how two or three moves could take you from your initial odds, 8%, and give you a better-than-even chance of reaching the top quintile, even only with average scores on endowment and trends. While even one move is hard, in the face of the pressure from the social side of strategy, it's important to pull as many levers as you can. Big moves are asymmetric. Here's the good news. Four of the five moves are asymmetric. In other words, the upside possibility far outweighs the downside risk. While M&A is often touted as high risk, when it comes to whether you move up or down the power curve, organic strategies are just as risky, and programmatic M&A not only increases your odds of moving up the curve, but simultaneously decreases your odds of sliding down. These are truly one-sided bets. The same is true for improving your productivity or gross margin relative to your industry. Making those moves increases your odds of winning while decreasing your risks. Resource reallocation slightly increases the chances of moving down because you may be moving into an industry with a poorer trend than your current industry, but nearly doubles the odds of reaching the top quintile. CapEx is the only lever that symmetrically changes the odds of going up and down. By increasing CapEx, your chances of going up the power curve increase, but so do the chances of dropping down. A big CapEx play amplifies rather than tilts the odds, reinforcing the importance of choosing very carefully the industry and geographic trends you are betting on. The fear among executives is that making big moves might improve the odds of moving up, but might also bring more risk of stumbling. But that narrative is false. We can now prove that pulling these five levers improves the odds of going up the power curve and reduces the odds of going down. There goes the excuse for playing it safe, for having low ambition, or for not pushing the organization to outperform at least your own industry. In fact, not moving is probably the riskiest strategy of all. you not only risk stagnation on the power curve, but you miss out on an additional reward that is completely inaccessible to non-movers, growth capital. It mostly flows to the winners, condemning many laggards to playing along. Big moves are cumulative, not silver bullets. You don't just wake up one day and decide you're going to have better productivity and then expect it to be there the next day. Rather, what you'll find is that making these big moves is really the accumulation of good practices that build up over time. The companies that successfully deliver on their big moves make them a part of their day-to-day mantra. It's the constancy of purpose that makes moves turn into big moves. When you think about it, the analysis of endowment, trends, and moves is a rather new way of looking at good strategy and what it takes to execute strategy in the real-life context of our companies. We have measured the probability of good strategy, explained how you can know your own odds, and explored the levers that you need to pull to improve your odds and get to big moves. We now have the outside view that can be used to address the social side of strategy. With this, there is hope that good strategy is possible for you and for your business. In the next and final chapter, we will get very practical about what you can do to improve your chances of beating the odds. Chapter 8. 8 Shifts to Unlock Strategy. Let's get very practical. There is a new way to give your strategy a chance, and it's going to take 8 big shifts. We started this journey of discovery by wondering how it could be that in today's world of big data analytics, the hockey stick remains the iconic image of strategy, even though so few pan out. We were puzzled that challenges, such as peanut buttering that were talked and written about 40 or 50 years ago, remain so similar to the challenges that business leaders share with us all the time. They wish to reallocate resources to more attractive growth opportunities, for instance, but still find that resources are as sticky as glue. After reading the previous chapters, you might agree that we are at the brink of a very different and much more exciting era in strategy. We now know the odds of strategy. We now know what we can do to improve those odds, and we can now much better define strategies, i.e., the big moves that beat the odds. One hurdle remains. While we better understand how the social side of strategy prevents big moves, we still haven't fully prescribed how to effectively address these social barriers. The question remaining, the one we want to try to answer in this final chapter, is the one that probably matters most to you. What does all this mean for how you run your strategy process, how you lead your team, how you create and execute strategies, and how you can achieve better business outcomes? Honoring our pledge to not throw new frameworks at you, we still want to offer reflections about how to change your game in very practical ways that will help you break through the social barriers. We will propose 8 shifts, specific areas where you can change what's happening in your strategy room, practical shifts that you can work on starting Monday morning. The 8 shifts synthesize what we have learned about how to address the social side of strategy. See Exhibit 29. 1. From annual planning to strategy as a journey. When you ask business leaders around the world where they make most strategy decisions, the answer is rarely in the strategy room or the board room. You are much more likely to hear in the shower before I went to meet my senior team or over that dinner conversation with the CEO of my major customer. One of our clients in East Asia regularly makes the most important business decisions on the golf course in consultation with his 3 fortune tellers, with whom he regularly plays. We are not kidding. Others confirm that going for a walk with other key decision-makers helps them with alignment and direction setting and reduces anxiety and opposition. What's broken in the strategy room? As important as a regular planning cycle might be for ensuring that all important questions are being surfaced and that budget processes are being informed, a regular, standardized cycle is not terribly well suited to the dynamic nature of today's business environment. In fact, trying to solve your big strategic questions and lock down an agreed plan at the same time can be near impossible. You can be sure the urgent will dominate the important, and those big questions won't get the airtime. Besides, those messy, non-linear,